Chapter 18. After a fruitless excursion to the archives of the Library of Congress, where he had hoped to find documentary evidence leading to the Concepcion's ultimate fate, Julian Perlmutter sat in the vast reading room. He closed a copy of the diary kept by Francis Drake, and later presented to Queen Elizabeth, describing his epic voyage. The diary, lost for centuries, had only recently been discovered in the dusty basement of the Royal Archives in England. He leaned his great bulk back in the chair and sighed. The diary added little to what he already knew. Drake had sent the Concepcion back to England under the command of the Golden Hind's sailing master, Thomas Cuttle. The galleon was never seen again and was presumed lost at sea with all hands. Beyond that, the only mention of the fate of the Concepcion was unverified. It came from a book Perlmutter could recall reading on the Amazon River, published in 1939 by journalist-explorer Nicholas Bender, who followed the routes of the early explorers in search of El Dorado. Perlmutter called up the book from the library staff and re-examined it. In the note section there was a short reference to a 1594 Portuguese survey expedition that had come upon an Englishman living with a tribe of local inhabitants beside the river. The Englishman claimed that he had served under the English sea dog, Francis Drake, who placed him in command of a Spanish treasure galleon that was swept into a jungle by an immense tidal wave. The Portuguese thought the man quite mad and continued on their mission, leaving him in the village where they found him. Perlmutter made a note of the publisher. Then he signed the Drake diary and Bender's book back to the library staff and caught a taxi home. He felt discouraged, but it was not the first time he had failed to run down a clue to a historical puzzle from the 25 million books and 40 million manuscripts in the library. The key to unlocking the mystery of the Concepcion, if there was one, had to be buried somewhere else. Perlmutter sat in the back seat of the cab and stared out the window at the passing automobiles and buildings without seeing them. He knew from experience that each research project moved at a pace all its own. Some threw out the key answers with a shower of fireworks. Others entangled themselves in an endless maze of dead ends and slowly died without a solution. The Concepcion enigma was different. It appeared as a shadow that eluded his grip. Did Nicholas Bender quote a genuine source, or did he embellish a myth, as so many nonfiction authors were prone to do? The question was still goading his mind when he walked into the clutter that was his office. A ship's clock on the mantel read 3:35 in the afternoon. Still plenty of time to make calls before most businesses closed. He settled into a handsome leather swivel chair behind his desk and punched in the number for New York City information. The operator gave him the number of Bender's publishing house almost before he finished asking for it. Then Perlmutter poured a snifter of Napoleon brandy and waited for his call to go through. No doubt one more wasted effort, he thought. Bender was probably dead by now, and so was his editor. "Faulkner and Massey," answered a female voice, heavy with the city's distinct accent.
"I'd like to talk to the editor of Nicholas Bender, please."
"Nicholas Bender?"
"He's one of your authors."
"I'm sorry, sir, I don't know the name."
"Mr. Bender wrote nonfiction adventure books a long time ago. Perhaps someone who has been on your staff for a number of years might recall him."
"I'll direct you to Mr. Adams, our senior editor. He's been with the company longer than anyone I know."
"Thank you."
There was a good 30-second pause, and then a man answered.
"Frank Adams here."
"Mr. Adams, my name is St. Julian Perlmutter."
"A pleasure, Mr. Perlmutter. I've heard of you.
You're down in Washington, I believe.
Yes, I live in the capital.
Keep us in mind should you decide to publish a book on maritime history.
I've yet to finish any book I started, Perlmutter laughed. We'll both grow old waiting for a completed manuscript from me.
At 74, I'm already old, said Adams congenially.
The very reason I rang you, said Perlmutter. Do you recall a Nicholas Bender?
I do indeed. He was somewhat of a soldier of fortune in his youth. We've published quite a few of the books he wrote describing his travels in the days before globe-trotting was discovered by the middle class.
I'm trying to trace the source of a reference he made in a book called On the Trail of El Dorado.
That's ancient history. We must have published that book back in the early 40s.
1939, to be exact.
How can I help you?
I was hoping Bender might have donated his notes and manuscripts to a university archive. I'd like to study them.
I really don't know what he did with his material, said Adams. I'll have to ask him.
He's still alive? Perlmutter asked in surprise.
Oh, dear me, yes. I had dinner with him not more than 3 months ago.
He must be in his 90s.
Nicholas is 84. I believe he was just 25 when he wrote On the Trail of El Dorado. That was only the second of 26 books we published for him. The last was in 1978, a book on hiking in the Yukon.
Does Mr. Bender still have all his mental faculties?
He does indeed. Nicholas is as sharp as an ice pick, despite his poor health.
May I have a number where I can reach him?
I doubt whether he'll take any calls from strangers. Since his wife died, Nicholas has become somewhat of a recluse. He lives on a small farm in Vermont, sadly waiting to die.
I don't mean to sound heartless, said Perlmutter, but it is most urgent that I speak to him.
Since you're a respected authority on maritime lore and a renowned gourmand, I'm sure he wouldn't mind talking to you. But first let me pave the way just to play safe. What is your number should he wish to call you direct?
Perlmutter gave Adams the phone number for the line he used only for close friends.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. If I ever do write a manuscript on shipwrecks, you'll be the first editor to read it.
He hung up, ambled into his kitchen, opened the refrigerator, expertly shucked a dozen Gulf oysters, poured a few drops of Tabasco and sherry vinegar into the open shells, and downed them accompanied by a bottle of Anchor Steam beer. His timing was perfect. He had no sooner polished off the oysters and dropped the empty bottle in a trash compactor when the phone rang.
"Julian Perlmutter here."
"Hello," replied a remarkably deep voice.
"This is Nicholas Bender. Frank Adams said you wished to speak to me."
"Yes, sir, thank you. I didn't expect you to call me so soon."
"Always delighted to talk to someone who has read my books," said Bender cheerfully. "Not many of you left."
"The book I found of interest was On the Trail of El Dorado."
"Yes, yes, I nearly died 10 times during that trek through hell."
"You made a reference to a Portuguese survey mission that found a crewman of Sir Francis Drake living among the natives along the Amazon River."
"Thomas Cuttle," Bender replied without the slightest hesitation. "I recall including the event in my book, yes."
"I wonder if you could refer me to the source of your information," said Perlmutter, his hopes rising with Bender's quick recollection.
"If I may ask, Mr. Perlmutter, what exactly is it you are pursuing?"
"I'm researching the history of a Spanish treasure galleon captured by Drake. Most reports put the ship lost at sea on its way back to England. But according to your account of Thomas Cuttle, it was carried into a rainforest on the crest of a tidal wave.
That's quite true, replied Bender. I'd have looked for her myself if I had thought there was the slightest chance of finding anything. But the jungle where she disappeared is so thick, you'd literally have to stumble and fall on the wreck before you'd see it.
You're that positive the Portuguese account of finding Cuttle is not just a fabrication or a myth?
It is historical fact. There is no doubt about that.
How can you be so sure?
I own the source.
Perlmutter was momentarily confused.
I'm sorry, Mr. Bender, I miss your point.
The point is, Mr. Perlmutter, I have in my possession the journal of Thomas Cuttle.
The hell you say, Perlmutter blurted.
Indeed, Bender answered triumphantly. Cuttle gave it to the leader of the Portuguese survey party with the request that it be sent to London. The Portuguese, however, turned it over to the viceroy at Macapá. He included it with dispatches he forwarded to Lisbon, where it passed through any number of hands before ending up in an antique bookstore, where I bought it for the equivalent of $36. That was a lot of money back in 1937, at least to a lad of 23 who was wandering the globe on a shoestring. The journal must be worth considerably more than $36 today.
I'm sure of it. A dealer once offered me $10,000 for it.
You turned him down?
I've never sold mementos of my journeys so someone else could profit.
May I fly up to Vermont and read the journal? Asked Perlmutter cautiously.
I am afraid not.
Perlmutter paused as he wondered how to persuade Bender to allow him to examine Cuttle's journal.
May I ask why?
I'm a sick old man, Bender replied, whose heart refuses to stop.
You certainly don't sound ill.
You should see me.
The diseases I picked up during my travels have returned to ravage what's left of my body. I am not a pretty sight, so I rarely entertain visitors. But I'll tell you what I'll do, Mr. Perlmutter. I'll send you the book as a gift.
My God, sir, you don't have to.
No, no, I insist. Frank Adams told me about your magnificent library on ships. I'd rather someone like you who can appreciate the journal possess it rather than a collector who simply puts it on a shelf to impress his friends.
That's very kind of you, said Perlmutter sincerely. I'm truly grateful for your kind generosity.
Take it and enjoy, Bender said graciously.
I assume you'd like to study the journal as soon as possible.
I don't want to inconvenience you.
Not at all. I'll send it Federal Express, so you'll have it in your hands first thing tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Bender. Thank you very much. I'll treat the journal with every bit of the respect it deserves.
Good. I hope you find what you're looking for.
So do I, said Perlmutter, his confidence soaring over the breakthrough. Believe me, so do I.
At 10:20 the next morning, Perlmutter threw open the door before the Federal Express driver could punch the doorbell button.
You must be expecting this, Mr. Perlmutter, said the young, black-haired man, wearing glasses and a friendly smile.
Like a child waiting for Santa,
Perlmutter laughed, signing for the reinforced envelope. He hurried into his study, pulling the tab and opening the envelope as he walked. He sat at his desk, slipped on his glasses, and held the journal of Thomas Cuttle in his hands as if it were the Holy Grail. The cover was the skin of some unidentifiable animal, and the pages were yellowed parchment in a state of excellent preservation. The ink was brown, probably a concoction Cuttle had managed to brew from the root of some tree. There were no more than 20 pages. The entries were written in the quaint Elizabethan prose of the day. The handwriting seemed labored, with any number of misspellings, indicating a man who was reasonably well-educated for the times. The first entry was dated March 1578, but was written much later. "Mine Strange History of the Past 16 Years," by Thomas Cuttle, formerly of Devonshire. It was the account of a shipwrecked sailor, cast away after barely surviving the sea's violent fury, only to endure incredible hardships in a savage land in his unsuccessful attempt to return home. As he read the passages, beginning with Cuttle's departure from England with Drake, Perlmutter noted that it was written in a more honest style than narratives of later centuries, which were littered with sermons, romantic exaggerations, and clichés. Cuttle's persistence, his will to survive, and his ingenuity in overcoming terrible obstacles without once begging for the help of God, made a profound impression on Perlmutter. Cuttle was a man he would like to have known. After finding himself the only survivor on the galleon after the tidal wave carried it far inland, Cuttle chose the unknown horrors of the mountains and jungle rather than capture and torture by the avenging Spanish, who were mad as wasps at the audacious capture of their treasure galleon by the hated Englishman, Drake. All Cuttle knew was that the Atlantic Ocean lay somewhere far to the east. How far, he could not even guess. Reaching the sea, and then somehow finding a friendly ship that might carry him back to England, would be nothing short of a miracle. But it was the only path open to him. On the western slopes of the Andes, the Spanish had already created colonies of large estates, now worked by the once proud Incas, who were enslaved and greatly reduced in numbers by inhumane treatment and infection from measles and smallpox. Cuttle crept through the estates under cover of darkness, stealing food at every opportunity. After 2 months of traveling a few short kilometers each night to elude the Spanish and remain out of sight of any Indians who might give him away, he crossed over the continental divide of the Andes, through the isolated valleys, and descended into the green hell of the Amazon River basin. From that point on, Cuttle's life became even more of a nightmare. He struggled through unending swamps up to his waist, fought his way through forests so thick every meter of growth had to be cut away with his knife. Swarms of insects, snakes, and alligators were a constant peril, the snakes often attacking without warning. He suffered from dysentery and fever, but still struggled on, often covering only 100 meters, 328 feet, during daylight. After several months, he stumbled into a village of hostile natives, who immediately tied him with ropes and kept him imprisoned as a slave for 5 years. Cuttle finally managed to escape by stealing a dugout canoe and paddling down the Amazon River at night under a waning moon. Contracting malaria, he came within an inch of dying, but as he drifted unconscious in his canoe, he was found by a tribe of long-haired women who nursed him back to health. It was the same tribe of women the Spanish explorer Francisco de Orellana had discovered during his futile search for El Dorado. He named the river Amazonas, in honor of the Amazon warriors of Greek legend, because the native women could draw a bow with any man. Cuttle introduced a number of labor-saving devices to the women and the few men who lived with them. He built a potter's wheel and taught them how to make huge, intricate bowls and water vessels. He constructed wheelbarrows and water wheels for irrigation, and showed them how to use pulleys to lift heavy weights. Soon looked upon as a god, Cuttle made an enjoyable life among the tribe. He took three of the most attractive women as wives, and quickly produced several children. His desire to see home again slowly dimmed. A bachelor when he left England, he was sure there would be no relatives or old shipmates left to greet his return. And then there was the possibility that Drake, a stern disciplinarian, would demand punishment for losing the Concepcion. No longer physically capable of suffering the deprivations and hardships of a long journey, Cuttle reluctantly decided to spend the remaining years of his life on the banks of the Amazon. When the Portuguese survey party passed through, he gave them his journal, requesting that it be somehow sent to England and placed in the hands of Francis Drake. After Perlmutter finished reading the journal, he leaned back in his swivel chair, removed his glasses, and rubbed his eyes. Any doubts he might have had in the back of his mind about the authenticity of the journal had quickly evaporated. The writing on the parchment showed strong, bold strokes, hardly the work of a madman who was sick and dying. Cuttle's descriptions did not seem fabricated or embellished. Perlmutter felt certain the experiences and hardships suffered by Francis Drake's sailing master truly occurred, and that the account was honestly set down by someone who lived what he wrote. Perlmutter went back to the heart of his quest, Cuttle's brief mention of the treasures left on board the Concepcion by Drake. He resettled his glasses on his imposing red nose and turned to the final entry of the narrative. "Me mind is as set as a stout ship before a north wind. I shall not return to my homeland. I fear Captain Drake was maddened for me not bringing the ancient treasures and the jade box with the knotted string to England, so's it could be presented to good Queen Bess. I left it with the wrecked ship. I shall be buried here among the people who have become my family." Written by the hand of Thomas Cuttle, sailing master of the Golden Hind, this unknown day in the year 1594. Perlmutter slowly looked up and stared at a 17th-century Spanish painting on his wall. Perlmutter slowly looked up and stared at a 17th-century Spanish painting on his wall, depicting a fleet of Spanish galleons sailing across a sea under the golden orange glow of a setting sun. He had found it in a bazaar in Segovia, and took it home for a tenth of its real value. He gently closed the fragile journal, lifted his bulk from the chair, and began to pace around the room, hands clasped behind his back. A crewman of Francis Drake had truly lived and died somewhere along the Amazon River. A Spanish galleon was thrown into a coastal jungle by an immense tidal wave, and a jade box containing a knotted cord did exist at one time. Could it still lie amid the rotting timbers of the galleon, buried deep in a rainforest? A 400-year-old mystery had suddenly surfaced from the shadows of time and revealed an enticing clue. Perlmutter was pleased with his successful investigative effort, but he well knew that confirmation of the myth was merely the first enticing step in a hunt for treasure. The next trick, and the most perplexing one, was to narrow the theater of search to as small a stage as possible.